I'm Thea Card with a check of the KDLG local news. The bail hearing for Jennifer Williams, the Togiak woman who was arrested for allegedly smoking oxycodone in the Kanackanack Hospital earlier this month, was held on Tuesday. The state recommended a third-party custodian and a cash bail set at $15,000 because of the severity of the charges, 1A and 1C felony charges. However, Magistrate Christina Ray set bail at $1,500 and required Williams' mother, Sarah, be her third-party custodian. Following Williams' bail hearing was Alexandria Smithmeyer, who allegedly stole a truck at the Kanackanack Hospital. She is facing a Class C felony. Smithmeyer, who has 7 prior misdemeanor convictions, will have to choose between a third-party custodian or a $2,500 bail later this month. Two candidates running for Alaska governor debated during a forum last Tuesday in Fairbanks. Sean Parnell defended his administration when Bill Walker questioned what the current governor is doing about the high cost of energy in the interior.
I am totally focused on reducing energy costs and fuel costs here in the interior and across the state. And when I think about one of the ways that I've worked to do that in this gas line negotiations and the agreements that have been signed, I made sure that Fairbanks residents would pay the lowest price cost for gas, whether that is Cook Inlet prices or whether that is North Slope prices.
Candidate Bill Walker says the cost of energy is his top priority.
You know, Governor Parnell has had 6 years to bring down the cost of energy in Fairbanks, and I plan to bring down the cost of energy. We need an immediate plan, a midterm, and a long-term plan. The first thing I'll do as governor, I will issue a declaration of disaster on the cost of energy in interior Alaska.
Walker says he believes the declaration will make a difference because it will bring greater attention to the cost of energy in the region. The candidates also address the closure of the Flint Hills refinery in North Pole. Bill Walker says the governor simply didn't do enough to keep the refinery open.
Well, the first thing I would have done, what we should have done, is the governor should have met with them after they came to see him months before the announcement of shutting down, asking for help, saying we're in trouble, can you help us? I would have gotten back to them with a solution, be part of the solution.
Governor Parnell says he made an effort to keep the refinery open, and he was surprised by the closure.
I told them, this is your moment to go speak with the Attorney General. Now, my Attorney General is Mike Garrity, a Fairbanks boy. Do you really think that he would just sit there and do nothing, or do you think he went to work with it? I'll submit that the refinery closing was a huge blow. It is nothing, it's something that caught me by surprise, but it is not something that I anticipated.
The forum was hosted by the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce. Governor Sean Parnell announced that Alaska will see a reduction in the unemployment insurance tax rate for the second year in a row. Alaskan workers pay 27% of the average benefit costs, and employers pay 73%. The Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development estimates the average tax rate will be reduced by 20% in 2015, saving an estimated $40 million. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game has released its summary report for the 2014 commercial salmon fishing season in Cook Inlet. As KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports, continued low king salmon numbers and new management tools were at the heart of this year's fishing.
The total number of sockeye salmon caught by Upper Cook Inlet commercial fishermen was down this year, some 20% less than the 10-year average, but at about $2.25 per pound, some $35 million worth of fish were still harvested. That dip in sheer numbers caught doesn't have anything to do with the run strength of sockeye, but rather the lack of run strength for king salmon.
The Chinook salmon, as everybody, or the king salmon, everybody knows, came back again 2014, pretty small runs.
That's commercial fisheries manager Pat Shields. Under new rules approved by the Board of Fish for this year, restrictions put on in-river fishing for kings had to be reflected in similar restrictions for the commercial fleets.
So when the sport fishery went to a catch-and-release fishery, starting on July 1, the commercial set net fishery started the season with no regular periods and then a maximum number of hours of 36 that could be fished during the year. And the department attempted to use those hours to maximize sockeye harvest and to stay off of kings as much as possible.
That was the big point made during those winter meetings with the Board of Fish way back in February. Let's target the sockeye when they're on the beach and then back off. And while this move was somewhat satisfactory, or at least a step in the right direction for in-river users wanting more kings, the sockeye hunters were worried about over-escapement, letting too many fish back up the river. And those concerns weren't without merit. The Kisilov River saw record or near-record returns on several days throughout July, and widespread use of the Kisilov River Special Harvest Area, better known as the terminal fishery, continued this year.
It's an imperfect tool. You can use any analogy you want. You know, that we're taking a crescent wrench to rebuild a motor. But it's really the only tool we have to try to keep the sockeye escapement down in the Kisilov River, and then we use the drift fleet extensively to try to harvest as many sockeye as we can out in the middle of the inlet, and because they're a very minor harvester of king salmon.
The terminal fishery at the mouth of the Kisilov was actually designated for a totally different purpose. Originally, it was only supposed to be used when Kenai River sockeye numbers were down, the thought being that commercial fishers could hit the Kisilov until more reds came in further north. But now, and for the past few years actually, it's being used to let king salmon pass through, though new genetic testing tells us that a few Kenai kings get picked up there too.
You know, you put that all together in your basket of management options, and you mix it all up, and it doesn't come out very pretty. But it's really what we have to deal with, this inequality that we have right now, poor king runs and good sockeye runs.
Shields says concerns about overescapement on the Kisilov weren't limited to arguments heard during the Board of Fish meetings. They came pretty much immediately after the season began.
In the Kisilov sockeye run this year, from day one, put us in a box that are between a rock and a hard place that we really didn't want to be. And what I mean by that is there was a large escapement early, from the very beginning. They showed up strongly. So we figured out pretty early in the season that we likely were going to over-escape that system, not because we wanted to, but because of the large run that was coming back early and strong.
And in fact, both the Kenai and the Kisilov River saw sockeye runs exceed their hoped-for return numbers by more than 300,000 fish in the Kenai and about 100,000 in the Kisilov. The late-run Kenai kings hit the lower end of their escapement goal, with approximately 16,000 fish coming back. Just 5,300 made it back in the early run, and commercial fishermen also took in about 2,000 king salmon in 2014. The Board of Fish is scheduled to take up Cook Inlet issues again in 2017, but will be lobbied hard to move some of that work ahead this week. There are 9 out-of-cycle proposals for the board to hear about when it meets for a work session later this week in Juneau. Reporting in Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Alaska Congressman Don Young received the endorsement of the National Rifle Association for re-election to the U.S. House of Representatives. Young is the only candidate in Alaska federally endorsed by the NRA. The organization's chairman, Chris Cox, says Young is the only candidate in this race who has always and will always vigorously promote and defend the rights of Alaska's law-abiding gun owners and sportsmen. Young says he's a lifelong supporter of gun owners and sportsmen. Alaska's Medicare Information Office announced last week the enrollment window for Medicare prescription drug plans is now open and will remain open through December 7th. Although this process happens every year, the office is urging those who qualify to apply this year and avoid unnecessary costs. Medicare charges permanent late enrollment fees if any beneficiary does not sign up for Part D the first time they are eligible. Health Program Manager for the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services, Judith Bendersky, says although the enrollment window for Part D is the same time every year, it's often an issue.
And some people call on December 8th or in the middle of the year, they kind of wake up and realize they need prescriptions, and they find that they're locked out other times of the year.
Bendersky says anyone who is new to Medicare or has had it for a while can sign up for Part D as long as they are currently holders of Part A or Part B Medicare already. She reminds beneficiaries that prescription drugs are not covered automatically under Medicare. One must sign up for Part D.
Not all people need prescription drug coverage under Medicare. As an example, people who retire from the state of Alaska and have AlaskaCare have very good prescription drug coverage through that retiree plan. Likewise, people in many unions, such as IBEW and Teamsters and the postal workers, when they retire, not only do they get a pension, but they also get health coverage that covers prescription drug coverage. So Part D is optional.
For more information or to sign up for Part D Medicare, call the Alaska Central Medicare Information Office at 1-800-478-6065 or visit the Medicare website at www.medicare.alaska.gov. Conducting research at sea in Arctic ice-filled conditions is often a tricky endeavor, requiring a host of high-tech gear. KNOM's Jen Runkle has more.
In a few months, the ice-classed research vessel Sukuliak, owned by the National Science Foundation, will be equipped with about a half dozen Arctic-native ice testing sticks as part of the ship's safety outfit.
It's a multi-tool. Sometimes there's a hook on the end for retrieving stuff. The other end is used for poking the ice. It could be a harpoon with rib bone or some type of bone sticking out on the other end, again, to test the ice. Obviously, if it goes through, you don't want to step there.
That's Brandon Amasik, subsistence director at Koerik. He says it's a highly valued safety tool for Alaskans who live in coastal communities and venture onto the ice for hunting in the winter. By testing the ice in their path with the stick, they can prevent accidentally falling through the weaker patches. Amasik says his family always takes this tool with them on the ice because of its many functions.
If you do happen to fall through, hopefully you can catch yourself before you fall past your waist and pull yourself back out. If you do happen to fall all the way through, it's still there to where you can pull yourself up, like doing a pull-up. So yeah, again, it's just a safety tool. They almost always have a dual function, whether it's a harpoon, a retrieving hook, mooring hook.
Amasik says, fortunately, he's never fallen into the water himself, but he's seen it happen to others, and it can be pretty terrifying.
One of my brothers did fall in, and he said immediately it just took his breath away. He couldn't breathe. I mean, within seconds, you know, he's able to pull himself out. A lot of times, individuals that are out seal hunting, walrus hunting, they're miles and miles from the nearest town, village. You know, so I mean, if you do fall in, you know, you're going to be soaking wet. More than likely, you're not going to make it back to wherever you came from, because within a matter of minutes, hypothermia is going to set in, and then you're going to be froze to death.
The Sukuliak is not an icebreaker, but it is an ice-classed vessel capable of breaking through up to 2.5 feet of ice. The vessel will operate in ice during some of its research missions in the Arctic, and scientists may be walking out on the frozen sea to collect data samples, which means they must be prepared for potentially dangerous situations. Daniel Oliver is the Marine Superintendent at UAF Seward Marine Center. Oliver was in the U.S. Coast Guard before taking his current job, and he said it was through visits to coastal communities aboard Coast Guard icebreakers that he realized how functional and necessary the tool is. After consulting with NOM's Marine Advisory Agent, Gay Sheffield, he decided to request those ice testing sticks as safety tools for the Sukuliak.
I found it was pretty universal tool within the coastal communities that spend a good portion of their life out on the ice with the subsistence hunting and all. And, you know, from talking with a number of the folks from the villages, it certainly made sense to me, which is why, when we were looking at what we were going to carry on board Sukuliak for equipment, having this capability aboard made sense to me.
Perry Pungawi is a craftsman in Savoonga, a member of the National Science Foundation Sukuliak Oversight Committee, and alternate commissioner on the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission for Savoonga. Pungawi will be making the sticks with materials that Sheffield and Oliver have sent over to St. Lawrence Island. He says the tools are, quote, time-tested by ice walkers of Alaska. Oliver says he hopes someone from Savoonga, who is part of the ship's Science Oversight Committee, will be able to join the Sukuliak crew at some point during ice trials in order to share knowledge about the ice testing sticks and Bering Sea ice conditions. The Sukuliak is homeported in Seward, and it will be used by U.S. and international scientists. Its first funded science trip this fall will be in the Western Hawaiian Island chain. Reporting in Nome, I'm Jen Ruckel.
An Alaska group received a grant from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. In 1968, the Fair Housing Act was created to prevent landlords from discriminating. Although times are significantly different, there is still discrimination which prevents some people from getting housing. In a report published by the U.S. HUD, in 2010, there were over 10,000 housing discrimination complaints filed. The highest percentage of complaints were filed based on disability at 48%, followed by race at 34%, and marital status at 15%. HUD awarded more than $38 million in 2014 to more than 120 fair housing organizations. These grants are part of the Fair Housing Initiatives Program, which is intended to enforce the Fair Housing Act through investigations of potential discriminatory practices and help educate housing providers, local governments, and potential victims of discrimination. The Alaska Legal Services Corporation was awarded $250,000 from the Fair Housing Initiatives Program. Executive Director of ALS, Nicole Nelson, says this is the first project in Alaska to receive money from the Fair Housing Program.
They're very competitive applications. Last year, ALSC put it, Alaska Legal Services put in an application, and we received a really high score, I believe 98 out of 100 points, and there was only enough funding for one additional organization, so we didn't receive the funding last year, and so we tried again this year and were one of two organizations that were funded for this particular funding stream.
In the application, certain requirements had to be met before the grant was awarded. Nelson says a history of discrimination and proof that ALSC could raise more funds in the community to contribute to the grant are among the requirements the group met.
So one of the things that really helped us be successful this year, I believe, is that our community partners statewide really rallied together to help us show that we had the community support and the leveraging dollars that would really stretch those federal dollars.
ALSC provides direct assistance to victims of housing discrimination by receiving complaints, conducting investigations, and educating the community about fair housing. The Fair Housing Initiatives Program grant will go toward building the nonprofit housing organizations. Nelson says the year-long project will include education and outreach on the Fair Housing Act and the rights available to residents.
A lot of the work under the grant will be community education about the rights and remedies under the Fair Housing Act. And then also we intend to start a testing program. And what a testing program is where you sort of do like the secret shopper or blind testing to go into different areas and find out if housing landlords are actually complying with the Fair Housing Act or if there are violations, that they're discriminating against the folks based on ethnicity or disability or marital status.
Those who believe they've experienced discrimination may file a complaint by contacting HUD's Office of Fair Housing and Equal Opportunity at 800-669-9777. The state of Alaska is looking for conveyance of nearly 20,000 acres of uplands that at western boundary of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. These lands are not up for state ownership, but the concern lays in the years of incorrect mapping by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Governor Sean Parnell's administration works to build upon earlier work by the state on the boundary dispute. The renewed effort started in 2012 and includes historical and legal research. For several decades, the U.S. Navy and other branches of the military have performed a series of training exercises in the Gulf of Alaska during the spring and summer months. The Navy is required to file an Environmental Impact Statement, or EIS, which needs to be updated every 5 years. KCHU's Marsha Lynn has more.
My first question is, why has the Navy chosen this location?
The primary reason we're looking at the Gulf of Alaska is to be able to do joint training. So I'm sure you've heard of the Northern Edge exercise. It's a very large joint exercise, you know, between U.S. Armed Forces. So we've have Army and Air Force and Coast Guard and Navy, as well as the state and other federal and local agencies, as well as some non-governmental organizations that are involved in this.
This is Leanne Nakahara, Public Affairs Officer for the Navy's Northwest Region. She says although other military exercises are done off the coasts of California and Hawaii, the colder and rougher Alaskan waters are more challenging. But the area they've chosen encompasses four different seamounts in the Gulf of Alaska.
Within their map of the training area, there are actually designated areas of essential fish habitat for all five species of Pacific salmon. So that's right, they want to conduct these training exercises in essential fish habitat.
This is Emily Stolarczyk, program manager for the Cordova-based Eyak Preservation Council, whose mission is to protect the Eyak culture of the Copper River Delta and Alaska's wild salmon habitat. Stolarczyk is concerned about how debris left on the ocean floor will affect fish populations.
They are asking for permits to be able to explode real bombs, use real missiles, real torpedoes, naval gun shells, the heavy duck guns, and do two large carrier strikes. So basically exploding really big ships and sinking them.
In Valdez, I'm Marsha Lynn.
Many of the stories you hear during the KDLG local news can be found online at www.kdlg.org. That's a check of the KDLG local news. In Dillingham, I'm Thea Card reporting.